You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right. Well, you're going to hear a few minutes of yesterday's interview with Brigadier General Ron Bazikowski. Ron was a first lieutenant in infantry guy in Beirut in 1983 in October, on October 23rd. And so you're going to hear him talk about just a little bit of yesterday's, maybe 15 minutes of yesterday, and then he gets into the day of the bombing, what happened, and what they did. So without further ado, the rest of the story from yesterday. Embedded with the French as a liaison officer, did you notice the tension? All right, hold on, let me start it again. I muted the channel, and you're really not supposed to do that when you're trying to play it.
My guest this morning, Ron Bazikowski, Brigadier General, retired United States Marine Corps. We're talking about his time in Beirut. And Ron, let me ask you: did you? So you guys go in there, and essentially, you're a peacekeeping piece, and you're embedded with the French as a liaison officer. Did you notice the tension? And did the tension change when I believe it was it the New Jersey that was shooting off the coast when they started shooting in support of the Lebanese army? Did you notice, because a lot of people will point to that and the deadly fire from United States, if you can imagine, a United States Navy battleship out there booming off the coast. Was there anything that you guys detected in terms of, hey, something's wrong here?
Yeah, there definitely was a shift. So one of the things that the French defense had a totally different concept of deployment that because of their experience in Algiers and because of the city, their concept of deployment was to more of a traditional counterinsurgency type deployments. They would have squads out and living in buildings with families. They lived among the populace. They lived throughout the city. So you could really see that. You could see it clearly. That they had a different concept where the U.S., we had a centralized location down the airport, and we would patrol out from there. The French lived, and they patrolled between posts, and so they were, I think, in greater tune with the populace. But the populace in the northern part of the city, especially on the east, they told the French what they wanted to hear, I think, as well. But what we started noticing was, there was an increase of direct fire and then indirect fire. We noticed that so much so that towards the end of August and in September, we started getting indirect fire and Lieutenant George Losey and Sergeant Ortega of Alpha Company were hit by, killed by mortar fire. So now I've been the XO for Alpha Company, and definitely lost Colonel Losey, they're down two officers, so I returned to the airport. And you could, at different points in the airport, you could see what was going on. Like you could, from the center sector where we were, where Alpha Company was, when I went back, you could look up into the Shoot Mountains and you could see valleys that ran east to west, and we could see the artillery shooting. We were just itching to shoot back. In fact, we cheered when we heard naval gunfire going off. We were just itching to shoot with our mortars and artillery in response, because who wants to be shot at and be sitting ducks down there on the low ground? Nobody. So it was a huge boost for us morale when we started shooting. But again, that goes back to what I said about the principles of peacekeeping. We had no idea of how this would be perceived as being neutral or not being neutral. We were part of the enemy now.
And that kind of happens, and it really goes unnoticed by us. Let me ask you, I had Phil Smith on last week, and he said when he got there with 2-8, one of the first things that struck him was the proximity of the Chute Mountains to the airport. He said, they're right on top of you. And he said, I don't know why it didn't, hit me in the head, sooner. But when we showed up off the coast of, Beirut, and then he said we did an amphibious landing. When we got there, you look up and the Sheep Mountains just dominate the airport. He said it was pretty daunting. It was pretty daunting to be there.
No, that's correct. I agree. It was, they were right there. It's like California. You know, you come in just off of the shore and there are the mountains right backing up. And you could see up into the chute at different points. You couldn't see the Baikal Valley.
Right.
But you hear in Baikal Valley, and we knew all sorts of stuff was going on out there.
3 kilometers is the distance between probably the center of the airport and the mountains of the Sheep Mountain. I mean, you realize, it'd be somebody, you kind of look at the map, and you're like, oh, wow, that's pretty close. If you, then you measure it in 3 clicks. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. I mean, it was even closer at the southern end of the airport. I still, because the mountains closed down
right
to the coast.
Yeah.
And so we're within 50-cal range.
Yeah, it's like 2 clicks at the southern end. Like, you got to be kidding me. Well, hell, let me. I've got Google Earth out. It's just when he said that, I got on Google Earth and yeah, it's like barely 2 clicks at the southern end. Holy smokes! And I think, you know, as we look back on Lebanon, you know, until you revisit it, you know, and then you guys are in the midst of all of that. And then all of a sudden, as you guys begin to defend yourself, you guys, unbeknownst to you, the tide kind of opinion about us as peacekeepers changes, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Talk to us about, so much was made in the aftermath of the barracks bombing, of the rules of engagement there. It, you know, we've all learned that, you know, just something we live with, rules of engagement. Talk to us about the rules of engagement. Did you guys roll around with magazines and weapons? Were you trying to be peacekeepers in this violent? I mean, you're taking Marines killed in action, right? And how did you guys roll around on a daily basis, and what were the rules of engagement?
Well, we did a lot of drilling on the rules of engagement and weapons conditions. We did a lot of things like that, but I think the rules of engagement were confusing because I think the reason why the rules of engagement were confusing is because you had 2 sets. One when you're under fire and one when you're not under fire. And you had two different cards. You had a white card, I think, and a blue card. And so you, right away, we were complicating things because we were trying to be so specific. But I think the weapons condition were not a result of the rules of engagement. I think there's a lot of criticism about, you know, when you're on the interior guard positions, you had magazines in the weapon, but no round in the chamber. Crucifix weapons were not loaded. I think that weapons condition was internal policy for interior guard because we were having, and this was a function of training,
right,
we were having a large number of negligent discharges. And some of the biggest violators, I think, were, you know, officers and staff NCOs with the 45s. But, why do I say that? At that time, we never took our pistols to the field. And we didn't routinely use our pistols, and the 45 is so different than other weapons. But I do think Marines were not as familiar with weapons because we didn't have numerous rounds to extend. We would go to the last range and we may go to the field, but this was a time, you know, we were coming off of some austerity measures and this is just prior to the Reagan era. Reagan was in and he was credited with rebuilding or rejuvenating the military. But, you know, it wasn't unusual to go to the field and do a live fire exercise with 10 rounds of ammo. Marines just weren't familiar with the weapons and talk about the compressed time, they didn't have time either. And so there were negligent discharges, and I think one of the causes of the weapons conditions and reasons, it was more dangerous in the DOT headquarters to have a guard with a weapon, with a round in their magazine, or in the chamber, because negligent discharges, rather than anything else. So I think that the two are not directly related. I think there was 2 distinct things going on. One, the rules of engagement were complicated, but interior to the DOT, the weapons conditions were a function of concerns over the being more dangerous to have negligent discharges.
You know, Ron, it's interesting because, you know, at face value, when you hear, you know, how weapons are being carried, you think, oh, that's crazy. But when there's negligent discharges going on, I mean, talk about something that gets everybody's attention. Like, are you kidding me? I can recall at Camp Pendleton, officers taking, when we had to take pistols to the field, they would wrap them in plastic so they wouldn't get dirty, so they wouldn't have to clean them. And that's, I mean, I can't imagine that today, but that's the way it was. And, as you said, talk about lack of familiarity. If you don't use it, you know, we had, you know, issues with negligent discharges in Iraq and Afghanistan. Certainly weren't that many of them, but for units when they first got there, it seemed like everybody had them. And it was, you know, a failure to adhere just to the basics of clearing your weapon. Did you really look? Did you really stick your finger in there? No. Oh, you got in a hurry. And now look where we're at. And so, and that's with the Marine Corps in Iraq and Afghanistan that shot a lot before it went. And a lot of experienced guys. And so, but you still had those issues. So the rules of engagement, explain how rules change between the white and the blue card when you weren't under attack and then when you were.
It was returning, when you could return fire. If you could identify the target, you could return fire. If you couldn't identify the target, you weren't authorized to return fire. So there was quite a lot of nuance, and the detail. It actually took up two whole cards. I don't even remember all of the differences, but I do remember grilling the Marines on it and going over what-if scenarios, which was probably one of the best things that we could do, given the amount of time that we had and given the complexity of the rules of engagement.
Got an email for you. Mac, I'm listening, and Beirut, I look back on it, and I didn't understand it very well. I thought the Marines were there as peacekeepers and kind of doing their job. In reality, it looks like they got stuck into the middle of a shit sandwich, and then as we began to be more aggressive with our naval gunfire, got put in a very, very precarious situation, probably one that we really didn't understand well at the time, given the complexities of that region and our ignorance of those complexities, I would tell you, to include today. I'm curious, though, did Ron think, as platoon commander, that his guys were well prepared? Did he think that the rules of engagement put them at a serious disadvantage? So, Ron, at the time, did you think the rules of engagement put you at a serious disadvantage, or was it something like, because I got asked that in Iraq and Afghanistan, hey, you know, the rules of engagement, we hear your hands are tied, and my response was, our hands are tied. If there's Marines in trouble, we can do whatever we need to defend the Marine lives. You know, people that tell you that probably haven't really read the rules of engagement and haven't drilled into them, because if you have and you know them, you have everything in there that you need to do to be able to save Marine lives. So did you feel at the time that you guys, you know, were solid, or did you feel some trepidation relative to the rules of engagement?
Well, you know, we felt frustrated. We felt frustrated. We understood the rules of engagement. We understood what we could and we couldn't do. But we tried to focus more on what we can do rather than what we can't do. But, you know, some of the frustrations that you would experience it was things like, we were down in the center sector and we had a wall out there and there was a hole in the wall. We called it a hole in the wall gang. You could see the individual shooting from a hole in the wall, and then they would stop shooting and they would walk away. While they were shooting, you could engage, but while they walked away, you couldn't do anything. So not understanding why we had the rules of engagement that we had, it was very frustrating.
Hold on. So even after he's shooting, you positively identify him as a shooter, and then he stops shooting and walks away, you can no longer engage him.
Yeah, that's how we saw it, and that was the way it was, that the situation we were in.
That's tough. That's tough. How did your Marines must have been rip shit about that? They couldn't have been too happy.
Well, no. They were at first, but they, you start learning how to do things. And I will say, while we were not well trained at the beginning, completely well trained for a lot of different reasons, we really got brilliant in the basics and doing things. And you know, one of the things I think you use a sniper for things that you could do. It's because we wanted precision. We're trying to avoid the hole in the wall. The hole in the wall gang was in a place called Hooterville, Bergeron Barajnov, and collateral damage, there was a really high risk of collateral damage of the local civilians in a slum, basically, outside it, and we couldn't afford to alienate the population there by throwing kids or innocents or non-combatants.
Right.
So I could see, in hindsight, I could see why we had that. But what we did to overcome, we started getting brilliant in the basics. And I think a good example of the classic image of an untrained army is firing a machine gun freehand, a free gun.
Sure.
But using a TNA is much better because once you get locked on a target, when you want to fire, you're locked on and you're going to have power impact. So we would do things like set up machine gun on TNA. Somebody would start shooting, and we would quickly dispatch them at the time and not have to wait till they walked away and raised that in contempt. So, coming up with things like range cards and being able to communicate I still remember we had the hole in the wall gang. We had the skeletal building. It was a building that was like a skeleton. We had checkpoints all over the place. We were able to communicate very badly, using landline and radio. And we couldn't hit it from one area. We could oftentimes see it from another area and talk to people on the target and being locked in on a TNA or using innovation. We were able to adapt and overcome. So I do think that, instead of focusing on what we couldn't do, we learned how to focus on what we could do and really started to have success in quieting things down.
My guest this morning, Brigadier General retired Ron Baskowski. We're talking about his time in Beirut, and he's gracious enough to give up some of his morning here to join us on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. Ron, can you talk about what your snipers were able to do then? If they had different rules of engagement, what were they? So you positively identified somebody at the hole in the wall. Could the snipers continue to engage?
Yeah, but they were in a position. The snipers had the same rules of engagement. It was a hostile act initiated against a U.S. force. But the thing about them is they were more precise and they had a much smaller footprint, and they would, we'd often put them off the side or in between positions and high positions where they could observe and have a good angle. And then with their range cards, when the hole in the wall started, they could, hit targets very precisely or different targets throughout, Hooterville they could, engage. So, that was how we used the snipers. They weren't in the same kind of visible position that we were. We were in position that had overhead cover. They were more in sniper hide position.
Right. Talk about the day that the barracks was destroyed. First of all, where was the barracks relative to your position at the airport? So you're in the center part of the airport.
Well, actually, we changed positions. So this is one of the things that, in hindsight, I say, how wrong could I be?
Right.
There was a policy that was rotating the company. So Alpha Company started out at the southern end of the airfield when we first got to Beirut.
Okay.
Shortly after they rotated, up to the center part of the airfield. That's when Lieutenant Losey got killed. And then after about 2 months there, we rotated out to the Lebanese Scientific University, which was out there by the Green Line. So we took all these positions together. There was like a line that kept that provided like a buffer. So the Israeli Defense Force couldn't come inside a buffer zone that was set up by our position. And we were there to ensure they didn't get inside where the Muslim population was. So at the time we just couldn't understand. When we got everything perfect at our position, the battalion commander was moving us again. This is crazy. And then we got to go to another position and have to get that all fixed because the unit we just left hadn't done anything, and we had to fix the whole place and get that set up, and then we were going to move again. We just couldn't understand why we had to move, but in reality, I could see in hindsight the battalion commander's policy of okay incumbents was brilliant. You know, he wanted to stamp out this complacency. He didn't want us to be complacent and say, hey, this is perfect, this is the best position, there's everything we should know. He wanted us to see things differently. He wanted us to continually improve. He was addressing the boredom problem and all the problems that could happen when you had bored Marines with that.
Right.
So it was actually brilliant. But anyway, so the last time we were there, the last position we were at was the Lebanese Scientific University. So basically there was a big stretch of buildings between a slum called, I mean, nicknamed Cooterville, between us and the airport. But we could basically generally see where the airport was, but we were separated from the airport. As the crow flies, maybe about 2.5 kilometers, but you couldn't go through the slum. You had to take a roundabout way, so it was probably about 10 kilometers to get to the airport from our station. So we were at the Lebanese Scientific University, and we were having some firefights up there and increased indirect fire there as well. In fact, we had Mike Oiler, our forward air controller, he was up on the roof trying to spot for aviation coming in, and he was killed. He was hit by a 7.62 round right in the head, and we were not feeling too good about ourselves. So I was sleeping in the CP on a stretcher so I could hear the radios and everything like that, about 6:30 in the morning, we heard the explosion, and so we got up and started calling the guard post, trying to get a triangulation on where that explosion was.
And now, Avon, can I stop your word? Now, can you explain? So for those of us that remember, there's the coastline. A couple of footnotes. First of all, explain the Green Line to everybody who's never heard of it.
Okay. So the Green Line is the side of the road. And basically what happens is you look at Lebanon, Beirut is on a peninsula that jumps out into the Mediterranean. The Green Line is a road that runs north-south from Israel all the way up to Tripoli and Sidon. So it cuts off. It goes on the eastern side of the city of Beirut, and on the right is more of a mountain, and that's on the right side or the east of the Green Line was the Christian, and then on the west side of the Green Line, and then further west you go into the city, was more of the Muslim population.
Right.
So it was a demarcation that had separated the Christian east from the Muslim West. So one of the things that agreement for us coming in was that we would keep the Israeli Defense Force on the Green Line or to the east, so that they wouldn't be coming close to the Palestinian families that were left behind. So that was the purpose of the Green Line.
Okay, that's how it
is. Also known as Sidon Road.
All right, can you help us out with the geography? So you have the airport, and then you guys are at the Beirut Scientific University,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's about, you said, 10 clicks to the north.
Well, if you look at the airport in relationship to the city of Beirut,
right.
The airport is to the south of the main city,
right.
And then as you go north, it gets more and more built up. It goes from semi-detached to semi-detached to block type construction as you get into the city.
Okay.
So the airport is along the coast, and it pretty much controlled the coastal road. And then you had a large built-up area, which I call Hooterville, right next to the airport, between the airport and the side of the road. And then the Lebanese Scientific University was along the side of the road. So you have two north-south roads, the coastal road and the side of the road. I had positions at the Scientific University, mm-hmm. and then some checkpoints along the way on the outside of Hooterville, and then the southern part of the airfield. You basically had a line that ran east to west that served as a buffer and kept the Israelis, defense force, from coming any further west than the side of the road.
All right. Now, explain to us the location of the barracks. Was it the American University, and where is that relative to you?
No, it's the Lebanese. The BLT barracks was right inside that airport itself.
Okay.
And in fact, it was the old Lebanese Aviation Administration headquarters, and it was a four-story building. And it was inside the perimeter. In fact, that was one of the things. The Lebanese Armed Forces were really supposed to be the ones providing security. Now, we had our interior security set up, and we had checkpoints, and we had entry control points. The main entry control points set up with gates and barricades and barrels and serpentine entrances. And then north of that, there were Lebanese Armed Forces at a checkpoint. That would even keep anybody from coming in further. So, we were pretty much that was on the interior of the airport. So it was behind the line.
Okay. All right. I was struggling with the geography. All right. So you're off to the north. You hear, well, I'll tell you what, I'll just take one more break, and then,
sure.
And then we'll talk about that. My guest, Ron Baskowski, we talked about the complexity, and I'll tell you what, and if you didn't have any sense of it, and you haven't read a whole lot about Beirut, you know, and what the Marines were trying to do there, and just hearing Ron explain the different positions he was at, the fire that they came under, the rules of engagement relative to engaging, and then the complexities of how the Arab fighters saw the Marines, and maybe initially as peacekeepers and a way to keep them, keep the Israelis away from them, and kind of an insurance policy against the Israelis. And then when then we start shooting naval gunfire, then we get identified with the Israelis, and the Israelis is certainly not sympathetic to Yasser Arafat and what they were doing. And then, you know, once we get painted in that direction, I think the die is cast for what happens on October 23rd. So we'll talk about that next as we continue on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't go away.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
After 9 o'clock on a Monday, Mike McNamara with you. Check the weather here around the Marine Corps real quick. We're privileged this morning to be joined by Ron Baskowski, retired Brigadier General. Currently, Camp Lejeune, sunny in 87.
Yeah.
Sunny in 91 in 29 Palms right now. In Fallujah, 110 in the early evening there. Hawaii, dark, cloudy, 76 degrees. Camp Pendleton, cloudy, 68. Quantico, partly sunny, 87 degrees in the nation's capital, up by where Ron Baskowski lives. Partly sunny, 89 degrees. As we continue on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. First of all, Ron, thank you very much for taking time out of your day. I truly appreciate the visit and I can't tell you how interesting it is, I think, for me and for our listeners to get kind of a company-level view of the incidents that surrounded the deployment of multiple battalions to Beirut, Lebanon, in 1982 and 1983. So thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure.
So you're essentially as a company XO, Alpha Company, you're north of the airport. You're doing what a lot of XOs do, which is sleep on a cot in a CP, listen to the radio for anything that gets going with your platoons.
Yep, that's exactly what it was.
And then
every night.
A lot of XOs are smiling right now, listening to you. What And so then you hear the explosion, and it goes off at what, you said approximately 6:30?
Yeah, it was around 6:30 in the morning on a Sunday. And so the first thing we tried to do is start calling out to all our guard posts, and so that we had the moat. It was around the building had like a trench around the whole thing. We called it the moat. We started trying to figure out where this explosion was so we could triangulate and try to figure out where the impacts. Then we heard all the companies around the airport trying to get the BLT headquarters as well, trying to call the battalion. And after about 5 minutes or so, people calling and not saying anything back. Dave Greco, who was he might have been the FDO for the battery, the artillery battery. They're on a hill just above the battalion headquarters, and he came up and said, "Hey guys, but the BLT is gone." Nobody could figure out what he meant. BLT is gone. I mean, the building is humongous. In fact, that was where everybody wanted to go. When there was indirect fire, you wanted 4 layers of concrete over your head to protect you from the incoming artillery. And to hear that the BLT is gone, we couldn't imagine what had happened. We couldn't see it because the built-up area, the slums were between us and the airport. So we couldn't see that building, but we could see smoke coming up. We knew something was going on. And slowly but surely we were able to piece together what would happen. And ended up, the MAO headquarters took over for the battalion and commanded and controlling units. And slowly but surely we figured out what was going on. And then we were, for all intents and purposes, we were out on the extreme flank of the battalion's position in a large building, much like the headquarters, and we quickly put together that we had to do something different, and we dropped all the scaffolding that was around the adjacent building to cover all of the entryways so that nobody could come in the main entrance. So we also started the plan. We had some drive-ins with us, and we made some drive-in positions because there was a field between us and the slum, So all of a sudden we started getting the combat reporting saying that there's a hijacked Lebanese armed forces M113 packed with explosives headed our way, and so we were getting ready for the worst. So we were reacting, and the good news is the indirect after the BLT headquarters was blown up, there wasn't a lot of indirect fire, and there was no direct fire anymore. It was kind of a lull in the firing. Which I don't know if it was intentional or if it was just a coincidence. But we did a quick reassessment or a quick assessment of the situation and figured out that things had changed, and we started redoing our position and accounting for things that could happen to us similar to what happened to the BLT headquarters.
In terms of the immediate aftermath, who took control of the fight who took control of the fight afterwards?
Well, I think that the MAO headquarters, Colgarity's headquarters, they took over, and we started reporting them. But I think the best thing that they could have done is I'm trying to remember his name. He explained what had happened, and he pretty much decentralized and let every company, especially where we were, know what we're on. And we were on our own, but we had to keep on reporting. And I think by explaining what was going on and letting us take steps to improve our position to guard against further, that was probably the best thing. There was nothing we could do from where we were at the scientific university. So they let us pretty much operate and do a 360-degree security. And for a couple of days, we were pretty much on our own. We didn't go back for meetings. We didn't go back for planning. We made military decisions based on the situation we saw, and we reported up, and one of the huge things was accounting for people. So we, the DLC headquarters was placed as a transit center too, because it was, you know, that's where you would send people to go. They would, and they'd wait for transportation back to the ship. So we had some people that were going back to ship for physicals, for one-offs, for packages and things like that. We had to account for every one of our people, and make sure we had it. But, you know, at that time we didn't have internet, we didn't have, modems, we couldn't transmit through this. It was all, I fell phonetically, and the numbers, of our supply for Social Security. So we were accounting for people, for, you know, 200 people, by getting the list of our names, one at a time. And you take that, you know, every company having to do that. But that's especially because we were isolated or separated from the main defense. We were doing all those PSC-77s, and transmitting names one at a time, so we're coming for every single person. There was a lot of activity going on all at once, and trying to, most important, what I'm most proud of is how we quickly came and we did an estimate situation and revised our position, so we'd be prepared for this tactic.
Email question says this: Mac, I'm curious, after the bombing of the barracks, did direct fire engagements heat up for the companies? And in particular, it would appear that Ron's company, Alpha Company, being a little bit more detached, would have been an ideal target. Ron, did direct fire attacks step up while you, in the next few days?
Over time, it did pick up again. In fact, I think we were a little bit more liberal in interpreting the rules of engagement, and we were a little bit more aggressive in returning fire, even though I don't think the rules of engagement had changed considerably. It was just amplified that, you know, a moving vehicle coming at you higher speed is hostile intent, things like that, clarification. But, yes, we did have increased fire coming in and indirect fire as well. At least at the Lebanese Scientific University, and from the edge of the town, which was interesting. In fact, the night we were through, probably one of the greatest things I'll remember was the night we were through in the, from the library was the, pretty much the decision was made to pull that position, the Lebanese Scientific University position, out because it was not going to be maintained anymore. So we called our company commander back to the battalion for a meeting to make sure that they passed it. They want to pass over the radio and talk about the plans and have every coordination, all the coordination done. So he went in for the meeting at the battalion and was headed back. And I got a message from him to start preparing to do something arranged where we were going to withdraw. I knew he wanted me to withdraw. So we were preparing, and then we got in a huge firefight. In fact, it was probably one of the biggest firefights that I remember. We fired all of our 60-millimeter mortar ammo to quiet this thing, quiet down this heavy gun that was fired at us from the town. And I think the thing that really stopped the firing and the firefight from happening was just a huge rainstorm came up, and it almost seemed like the guys would do their day job and then they'd come at night and fight, and then they would go to bed and go to work the next day and then come home from work and fight the next day. Well, this rainstorm quieted things down, and it was really quiet. So now the company commander, who was outside of our CP, was able to come in after the rain stopped, after the firing had stopped, and he told us we're leaving, and we're going to have, you know, 17 trucks come up here in a tow truck, and we're going to move out. So we did a quick side order, and we planned to pull out of the Lebanese Scientific University. About 1 o'clock in the morning, all the trucks arrived. We loaded up our gunny, was absolutely determined. Kenny Butler, he was absolutely determined that no U.S. property was going to be left at the Scientific University. He got everything out of there, had everything loaded, and we got in that convoy. But everything was narrow roads. The rain made everything muddy. A truck got stuck. I was at the end of the convoy. We ended up sitting there for a long time. Something just didn't seem right. And it's getting closer and closer to daylight now. And I'm getting worried. Here we are sitting right where we had this major firefight the night before, which was our truck trying to pull out of town. We found out that we had trucks just stuck. We pulled those out. We only had one wrecker pull out those trucks. Got moving. And basically had two convoys. And to get back to the airport, we had to go all the way up, right along the Green Line, then through the city of Beirut, and then down the coastal highway. It was quite an evolution, but this is where having been the French liaison officer paid off. Because I was familiar with the northern part, it was easy for me to take the second half of the convoy and catch back up. And we caught up just as we were entering back in the line. The company commander already pretty much let me run that second half of the convoy. He knew, later said, you know, he knew that I had it because of my familiarity with the French sector. And I knew where to go. I was going to go into the Hippodrome if we had any problems. So it was a great feeling that night when we got inside the airport and then later back loading onto the ship. Probably never slept better in my life as when we got back on the Harlan County, which was the LST. And even though it was bobbing and rocking, I never thought sleep could feel so good.
What was you get back, and again, are you riding in a Jeep or are you in a truck?
At that time, I was in a truck.
Okay. So now this is not the era of the Humvee, by the way.
No, it was the M151.
The M151. That thing was good to go, too. Ron Baskowski, our guest, we're talking about his deployment with 1-8. We're talking about October 23rd and thereabouts. During that deployment. Ron, do you remember seeing the barracks when you got back?
Yeah.
And what was that like? What was that like?
That's everybody. When we came into the airport, everybody wanted to see the barracks. Our last memory of it was, again, a four-story building. It was huge. It was probably about a 150-feet square building, four stories high with a huge atrium in it. And so we were all trying to imagine how could the DOT be gone. So when we pulled into the airport at about 7:30 in the morning, coming out of that all night convoy from hell, everybody's looking out trying to see it. It was just a flattened mess. You just couldn't believe it. But, it was just flat. Most of the bodies had been recovered by that. This was now in November. I think it might have been November 12th when we moved out. I remember doing the Marine Corps birthday at the Scientific University. And that was on the 10th. So this may have been a couple days after the Marine Corps birthday. Everybody's looking and we're just in awe that this huge building that was once huge, that everybody felt safe in, was just a pile of rubble.
The lessons learned from that deployment, obviously one that continues to be discussed and Marines study it in terms of peacekeeping missions and then the complexities of a region we don't have a whole lot of say at our level, but when you think about the lessons that you learned and from that deployment, what were they?
Well, I think first lesson I would learn was, you know, training is absolutely important. I think it was Rommel might have said the best form of welfare is first-class training, and I think that's absolutely essential. Brilliance in the basics. We got there. We did get to the brilliance in the basics after we were on the ground for a while and just from operating every day, but we should have deployed with that brilliance in the basics. I mentioned that we had about 40 guys get 40 NCOs and Lance Corporal squad leaders go to the squad leader school. That paid huge dividends because we could now communicate. We all had an understanding of what the standard was for a range guard. We understood how it was used. We were able to talk, crosstalk up and down because of all our squad leaders knew what to do because they had been to squad leader school and they knew what was expected with range cards and fire plan sketches and why it's not just going through the motions, it's actually a tool that you use to execute your mission. But I think that was a lesson that was reinforced. The more education that you can give Marines and get more training that you can do, the better off you are going to be when you're trying to do a complex mission. I think mission analysis is a key thing. I do think that our mission changed, and we changed the nature of our mission as time went on. But we didn't change enough things. We didn't have an understanding of the the reason why, you know, what do we knew what we were supposed to do, support the provide security, provide a presence, provide security for the, and support the government of Lebanon. But we didn't have an understanding of the first and second order effects that we were having by indirect fire. But incidentally, it wasn't just returning indirect fire that caused us to be perceived as a belligerent. You know, we were, in Lebanon, there was the Lebanese armed forces, they were seen largely as a proxy of the Christian militia, and they were one and the same. And then when we supported them with indirect fire, not that we supported ourselves with indirect fire, but even supporting the Lebanese armed forces, when we resupplied them, and when we gave them intelligence, it became clear. So up and down the chain of command, I think that even external to in theater or in country, decisions were being made not based on a full appreciation of the second and third order effects of these actions. But I think mission analysis and understanding the intent or purpose and what you're trying, the overall mission, what you're trying to accomplish is absolutely important. I learned some tactical lessons that I think later on helped me out as a company commander in Desert Storm, and then later on as an advisor in OIS. I mean, that's the imagination is a powerful force, and that's to really get spooked by what they think is going to happen. When we went to Lebanon, we were excited, and everybody was nervous about everything, because it was, even though it was a peacekeeping mission, it was, you know, we just saw thousands of people killed, and it was combat, and there were not a whole lot of combat vets in the battalion at the time. Nobody really knew what to expect. Even in my own case, when I told you I flew into from Cyprus on a CH-53, and I landed at the airport, and I was expecting that I'd have to get out of the helicopter like it was a hot LZ. And it couldn't be any further from the truth. When I landed, I felt like I was almost landing in an admin environment, and somebody's going to hand me up my tie or something like that. It was unbelievable. But your mind will play tricks on you because you imagine something bad can happen any minute, and you have no idea. So talking to vets and understanding what it can be like is a huge thing, and learning from others' experiences. So as we became more familiar with the environment and gained confidence, it was really exciting. We started building, we discussed about textbook examples. We built fighting positions that had overhead cover and that had machine gun positions inside the building when we were at the library at the Scientific University. And we started anticipating close lines. We were doing flashbang techniques. I remember he's now Lieutenant General Mark Barakas. He was our artillery FO. I remember sitting in a fighting position with him looking up the east-west valley up into the Chute Mountains. And we were doing flashbang. He introduced me to the OS band. And at the team, in sport observer team, we had a spot bunch. We were doing flashbang, and we were coming up with six-digit grids that later on, when the counter border radar would kick in, it would give us a 10-digit grid, which basically was the same as the six-digit grid that we were able to come up with in you know, quite a short amount of time. It was in 30 seconds of doing the flash-the-bang method. So the more familiar we became, the more confidence we had, and the more exciting. Nobody really cared about the showing. Now it became a, you know, how are we going to counter this, and how are we going to do that? And we had tremendous confidence as the time went on. But we didn't go in with that confidence. I think understanding or having training that puts you through some of the stresses gives you the confidence in your skills and allows you to operate. All of those are enough lessons. I certainly think that the mind is a very, very powerful force. You can talk yourself out of things very quickly.
No, you know, and Ron, you and I both know as the Marine Corps, as we went to Iraq and Afghanistan, as we got more and more experience, you know, you started hearing things commonplace, phrases like,
Well, you said you used one, brilliance in the basic. I remember first started saying slow is pro, and you used to hear that a lot, just about being steady, being measured. And then, you know, just as you, and the problem was back then that, you know, you guys were the only, one of the few battalions that, that you know, got that experience. We had a lot of guys. I mean, you were trained by, Vietnam veterans. I was trained at the basic school. You know, most of your peers, you were a young guy then, but the guys who, that you were snapping in with, most of those guys were, you know, had some experience as lieutenants in Vietnam. And so, it was, you know, but there was just not that much of that going around anymore. And so, I agree with you. That experience, that confidence that comes with operating, knowing you can do it, and having been shot at it, and having come back from it, and having improvised, having looked hard at it, there's nothing like that. And, you know, we do our best that we can in peacetime. But in retrospect, in looking back at that, it seemed like we were such a naive, you know, we were so different relative to operating in a joint environment. We were so different relative to the way we do intelligence and what you guys had to deal with over there. And, you know, it almost seems like we were babes in the woods relative to those kind of missions, the complexities that come with them, and our it seems like our maybe our lack of understanding of the subtleties that we certainly learned a better appreciation of subsequent to Beirut.
Yeah, I would agree. I hope we learned, Friedman, writes in Beirut to Jerusalem. He does a pretty good job explaining how we were, exactly what you were talking about. We were innocents too, that led to the slaughter. We didn't know what we were doing as much, and we didn't know that what we were doing was going to lead to second and third order effects. But it was exactly played, and it was played by people that's their culture for thousands of years. It's how people survive. So through the Byzantine type politics and power and alliances, it was, and we were just caught in a tangle. We came for a noble purpose, I believe. When you think about the loss of life, it just tragic and it's sad. If we don't learn from it, I think we have learned from it. It would be
even more tragic. Ron, I think that's the phrase they used on the memorial at Camp Johnson, isn't it? They came in peace. If I'm not mistaken. I think that's written on the memorial there. I want to switch gears and ask you about some current day Marine Corps issues.
Okay.
First of all, gender integration. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I gender integration, it's a tough one. But I always learned, and I used to say, I would think, you have to give your best military advice. And then whatever comes out, you have to execute as if, whether it's your, what your advice was, whether your advice is taken or not, you have to pull out with a full 30-inch stuff and execute as if it was your own. I think the Marine Corps leadership was very wise. They gave the best military advice to the civilian leadership, and they made a decision. And now it's the time to carry out the decision as if it was our own. But I think was really smart, and we got some really smart leaders in the Marine Corps. They commissioned a study. They did a very hard they did very well at doing a hard job of delivering an unpopular message to leaders. But they did it, and they now know a lot of the issues that they have to overcome and reasons why, what they have to do, or special needs that they have to make, or things that they have to do different with a fully integrated force. And I think there's many pundits that are critical of the Marine Corps senior leaders, or the senior leaders sold out. They're worried about their own careers. They copped out on this one. I think that those critics should just, until they walk in the shoes of our senior leaders, they should just keep quiet because they don't know what they're talking about. The gender integration is not going to be the end of the Marine Corps. Would it be easier if we had it? Sure. There would be less logistics out there. There would be less cultural things you have to do. It's a change. Change is always hard. But the Marine Corps will survive, and it will figure out how to operate with an integrated, gender-integrated force. that effectively operate, not just operate. And the way we're going to figure it out is that the leaders, that the senior leaders, are now solving the next strategic problems, like force levels in Afghanistan, keeping those levels high enough so we don't have to go back in 10 years from now. While they're solving the bigger strategic problems, now it's time for the tactical leaders to step up. They know what goes on. They now know what has to be done differently, and they have to figure out how we're going to do it so that the senior leaders can solve the bigger problems, the next big problems that are going to come up, and keep the Marine Corps and the U.S. And Department of Defense strong for the future. So can it be done? Yeah, it can be done. Am I confident? Yes, I'm absolutely confident. This is not the first time the Marine Corps has had to do something, or the military has had to do something that would be hard to do. We'll figure out how to do it, and we'll do it well, just as if it was my own idea. But I'm confident it's going to work out somehow, but it's failing because of the culture of the Marine Corps. When we're told to do what we're told to do, we're going to do it. We're going to do it better than anybody else.
Right. Let me ask another hard question about it. For instance, and I agree with you. Now, let me ask you the same question. Let's just suppose, for the sake of discussion, that zero or very few women get through the infantry officer course, and let's just suppose that very, very small numbers of women get into the infantry MOS. And Congress looks at the Marine Corps and says, hey, you know what? Your standards need to come more in line with the Army, or you need to lower your standards because we don't see this. Is there, because I think most Marines feel that, hey, I'm okay with this as long as the standard doesn't change. Do you see an issue with the standard? Is that a problem for you if we are directed to change our standards?
But I think if the standard causes you not to be able to accomplish the mission or not to be able to operate, then I think, that certainly is wrong. I want to be honest. We're told to do something. Let's be honest with what we can't do and what we can't live out and with what we don't want to live without. There's a difference between can't and not want to. I've always been physically fit and everything like that. I think in my whole 32 years in the Marine Corps, I've only been to the 300, maybe three or four times. But I remember as a battalion commander, we had to provide so many people. The reconnaissance was broken. We needed to provide candidates to recon for recon indoc.
Right.
And we wanted to do it. We were told to do it. We wanted to do it. But everybody we would give, they were getting rejected during the recon screening. And I wanted to find out I wanted to find out what was going on. So I took I volunteered myself to do the recon screening. Okay, and I'll be honest with you, I did great on the run. I did great on the pass mark. I did all of that stuff. But on my second running on the obstacle course, I hit my chest on one of the beams, and I took the wind out of myself, and I was hurting. I didn't clear that obstacle. So I would have been withheld from serving in recon, even though I could run a sub-3-hour marathon, a 300 GFP. I would have been excluded from the run, being accepted for reconnaissance because I failed to hit the vaccination. If we make a bar that it doesn't accurately reflect the standards that we meet, then I think we need to be honest as well. And I'm absolutely confident the Marine Corps will. Other positions in the infantry that you don't have to be, Johnny Weiss Mueller, sure. There's lots of positions. You always found a place for the guy that couldn't quite do all the pull-ups or that couldn't do it. What I'm concerned about is if you have if you have 10% that couldn't meet the standard before, that you're finding jobs for them as clerk or whatever, and they're doing essential things for you, job for you, if you start, you know, using have them now at 20% or 30%, maybe that could cause it. But that's the judgment call that the league is going to have to decide and make a determination on. But I don't think it's going to get to that point. I think the Marine Corps is showing good faith. They've laid out in the study, you know, what it takes and what is required. And they'll figure out how to do it and how to integrate and where it makes sense and where it doesn't make sense and carry off the spirit of the intent. And I don't think it's going to come to the civilian leadership saying, you're not doing what I told you.
Interesting. Okay. You know, and I don't, it's an interesting issue, and I hope you're right, and I hope the politics don't get into it, because I think the Marine Corps has done what's right. I think the Ground Combat Integration Task Force was the right thing to do. I think the data that they put out served to illustrate some of the challenges that trainers and schools will face, as well as leaders in the Fleet Marine Force. So it's an interesting issue. At its root is the lifeblood of the Marine Corps, I think, which is our infantry organizations and making sure that they are as tough and as formidable and remain that way for the future, because when they're not, that means more people are going to pay with their lives. And so it's an important issue. But you know what, Ron, I agree with you. I think that the Marine Corps has acquitted itself very well in terms of being brutally honest. And not simply rolling over and saying yes sir, 3 bags full. That we tried to articulate the difficulties of the profession and what we need, at the same time saying going about it smartly. And I think the Commandant's initiative to create standards for all the MOSs that didn't exist previous to that is statement to that. And he's of the mind that. It will have higher quality infantrymen across the board, and his school directors have told him as much. So interesting issue that bears out all the things that you said.
Okay.
Ron, first of all, I want to thank you for, again, taking a couple hours out of your morning to talk to us about your career and B, your thoughts on your deployment in 2019. 83 to Beirut and the challenges that you guys faced over there. So thank you very much for coming on this morning, and I hope you don't mind that from time to time I bother you and bring you back on and we talk about things Marine Corps.
No, Matt, my pleasure. Have you got time for one more lesson learned?
No, absolutely.
Okay, well, you know, in between when you took breaks, I heard your announcements.
This is kind of I'll be very honest, this is kind of embarrassing for me when I hear this. So I brought him on to talk about post-combat related mental health and Beirut, and then I got so interested in Beirut that I forget to ask him about post-combat related mental health. And so I'm getting ready to get off, and Ron stops me, and he says, "Hey, Mac, one more thing." And so a little bit embarrassing here.
I think it's a great message that you were saying about reaching out and support networks. You know, I never considered myself to be combat stressed or to have PTSD, but I did notice the first Christmas, we got back just before Christmas from our Beirut deployment, and I remember like being a troop service in Charleston, South Carolina, and just having a tremendous sadness all over me. And it really did affect me. And it was understandable. We just got back from deployment. It was really so, but I didn't think any of it. And then when I went to Quantico, my wife and I would go up to Arlington Cemetery either on the 23rd of October or just before or after, because of my work schedule. And we'd put flowers on graves. One of my friends, John Wood, was a Naval Academy alumni with me. We were in basic school together. We'd go. But I always noticed I'd get tense and irritable, and over time I just avoided situations that made me irritable and uncomfortable. And then throughout my career, though, I had to speak at birthday balls and at conferences and at meetings and things like that. And whenever I started talking about Beirut, and then later on about the sacrificing or honoring the gun book, I would just notice that my voice would begin to waver,
Right.
And it was starting to make me, I mean, get that deep feeling of sadness again. But so I just avoided those situations whenever possible. But when it came time to retire, I knew I was going to have to get up and make a speech. And the last thing I wanted to do was break down emotionally during a farewell speech. So I went to the doc and I said, hey, doc, give me a pill just to calm me down when I get a weekend. The doc was in Taipei, and she was fantastic. You know, she didn't just give me a pill. She did give me a pill eventually, but did a lot of counseling and understanding and other things with me. And it instantly had success. And in just 2 months of my retirement, I felt great. I felt wonderful. I just actually thought everything was good, and it didn't break down at all. But I retired, and I stopped taking my medication, which in the end I think was a mistake, because about a year later I went to Arlington Cemetery for the 30th ceremony commemorating the 30th anniversary of the bombing, and that brought it to Don Woolett's grave site. When I arrived at the cemetery, my throat just closed up. I couldn't talk. In fact, there were a couple of people that came instantly that tried to help me out, and the guy at the desk was trying to help me out, and I couldn't talk. I had to write down Don's name on a piece of paper just to communicate with the attendant. And I knew maybe I still needed help with dealing with some kind of painful memory. I never associated with being a painful memory with the week. I never really, it was just a feeling of sadness. But when I look back, I really feel foolish that I hadn't sought help for 30 years to get help for the phone. When I took the pills, when I talked to the doctor at KMA, there was an immediate relief. And I recognized that all the time that I spent avoiding my problem, the time that I didn't have to be miserable, and I was so happy. So I started taking my medication again. And I'm going to get off of it again in the near future. But I'm not going to go cold turkey like I did last time because there's no bad side effects. But there's somebody there to help. I'm just struck by that there are so many organizations and so much support available that if people feel it, if people understand, you know, they're not sure about whether help is needed or if it could help, I recommend if there's any doubt whatsoever, they just go talk to somebody. You don't have to talk to them. They're not going to be a big deal. It's just seek some help with any one of these organizations, and they're pretty good. They'll listen to you, which sometimes is all that it takes. And if it's something more serious, there's some not new. This is something that people are aware of. There's no stigma with it. I think there's more of a stigma right now that I was afraid to go for all those years. I kicked myself for not having done earlier. I think about the time, all the different things that I could have done and not feel as bad as I did. It would have been wonderful. It wasn't debilitating, but it was a gnawing angst it feels like a weight is off my shoulders now. So I applaud what you're doing. I applaud that the message of your All Marine Radio and what you're trying to do, the advertisements that you have between links, and I hope that the listeners take advantage of all the great organizations that are here to help. So thanks very much for letting me give that last lesson.
No, I apologize for not asking you, Ron. You know, but Ron, the culture that you grew up in the Marine Corps, you straddled two worlds in terms of what the Marine Corps was and then what it's become in terms of mental health. Nobody went to mental health. You know, when I was, you know, and I was a few years behind you, but nobody, who would go to mental health? Right? I mean, we joined the Marine Corps that was a drinking, fighting organization, and then I think I'd been on active duty for a couple years when it's like, what do you mean they're going to yank you out of your car at the gate and write you up for being drunk? Like, why aren't they just going to give you a ride home? Well, I mean, that's the way we used to do it. And, then Blackjack, I mean, you hear his talks now about alcoholism in the Marine Corps and whatnot. I mean, and it blows your mind. But that was the norm. And then into that, you're going to go. And these are Vietnam guys. I mean, they fought a war. 58,000 guys got killed. I mean, that was no shit on. And they didn't go to mental health. You know, so we're going to go to mental health. So, I mean, and now after, you know, coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and then the different iterations, and now we just take it like, yeah, you got to repair your body in the gym. You got to go repair your mind. You know, if it needs to be repaired, you got to go do that. You got to go talk to a therapist, and you might have to be medicated for a period of time so you can get to a better place. But it's now so much of a matter of fact. The biggest problem I see is people get off active duty, and they try to plug into the VA, and they're unsuccessful, and they get frustrated, and then they just kind of drift away. And your message is, don't drift away. There's a lot of organizations, you know, out there. Improvise, adapt, and overcome, but don't quit.
Absolutely.
Interesting. You know, I got great advice. I had a helicopter crash into my company's assembly area in 1993, up in Iron Palms, and everybody in the helicopter, you know, killed, but not before you tried to save them and you went through that terrible, you know, experience of trying as hard as you can to help somebody live, them trying to live, and none of it working out. My gunny looked at me and said, told me that this came from Vietnam, this piece of advice came from Vietnam, and I was fortunate that he was there. He looked at me and he said, you know you're never going to get over this. I said, what the hell does that mean? He said, hey, what that means is, he said, that comes from Vietnam. He said, and what that means is that it's going to bother you, and it's okay. I mean, it was such good advice for me to hear that whenever it bothered me, I didn't feel like I was a damaged person. I just felt like it was normal because of what that event had done to me and, you know, and trying to save people and watch them die and how that affects you. And I would give that advice to guys in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you almost see like this, like, oh, you know, like I'm not screwed up. Like this is normal for me now. But it's such a hard thing to navigate. And I call it my menstrual cycle. Some days I'll go to, you know, I've been to Arlington and had the exact same experience. I can't talk. I can feel the tears, you know, welling up in my eyes. And it's like, wait a minute. I was just thinking about this the other day and didn't have this reaction. Like, what is going on with me today? And it's tough to get your hands around. But you know, I'll tell you, sir, I mean, thank you very much for saying all that. And do you still see somebody now? Do you still go to counseling?
No, I don't. I don't feel like I need to. It was pretty easy. But you know, I can now talk about things that I would just avoid talking about. And I think that's the big thing. It's going there at first gave me enough that I could get over to the point where I could talk about stuff. And you need to find someone that you can talk to that maybe has experienced the same kind of things that you're comfortable talking to. You don't have to talk the whole world about it. But before I couldn't even talk about it, I would just avoid it. And holding it in, absolutely, I think holding it in is what made it worse. It just sort of it compounded itself over time.
All right. Well, again, Ron, thank you very much for coming on this morning, and certainly appreciate your candor and your time, and we will do this again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Okay, Mike, thanks for what you do.
You bet. That is Brigadier General, retired, Ron Vasikowski.
How about that? For since 1983, rolling around with that inside of you. But again, we didn't do mental health. You know, mental health is a recent invention. And, you know, one of the coolest things that we tap into on occasion is the handed down oral history or oral instructions about mental health from Marine generation to Marine generation. And Jeremiah Workman tells a story about advice he got. And the advice went something like, Jeremiah, don't let those monkeys out of the cage. Got to keep them in the cage. You let those monkeys out of the cage, all hell breaking loose. But you know, what's funny, what makes you smile is that there's a lot of wisdom in all of that. You know, what is he describing? He's describing that don't go dwell in that place. Don't spend a lot of time there. Stay away from it. You hear Cal Humphrey from World War II, the only battle that he participated in was the Battle of Iwo Jima. And he says, look, I will give my money to the VFW and the Legion. I won't go in those places, though. I don't want to talk about it. You know, and he said, look, I'm happy to come on a program like this and share my experiences. He said, and it'll keep me up for a couple nights. He said, but I don't dwell on it. I get up and read a book and I keep moving. And so that was the way you dealt with it. And I think it's a very cool part of Marine Corps. Well, you know, in my case is a perfect example of it is, you know, my gunny walks up and says, you'll never get over this. I'm like, what the fuck did you just say to me? And so, but that was the oral mental health tradition of the Marine Corps. And it was the best, if you ask me the best advice I ever got, that's the best advice I ever got in my life. And I've given it to a lot of people, as I told General Baskowski. The interview, the whole thing, you know, the rules of engagement of Lebanon, what they started to do, how they didn't understand the situation they went into, who was affiliated with who. So when you began to work exclusively with this group, you were identified with them. You were not a peacekeeper anymore. You were now a combatant and you were fair game. All of that, you know, escaping us. And so, I think it's very, very interesting. And then, you know, then his experience, you know, that day and then the mental health piece of it. So my thanks to Ron Baskowski for coming on. We'll take a break. We'll come back. The Gunner will join us here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. So whatever you do, do not touch that dial.